of Withholding Love. A trade route ran from the northeast of the delta through the arid southland of Canaan via Beersheba to Hebron. The children of Israel traveled on it, thus taking a somewhat different route from the one the brothers had used on their trips to buy corn. The region was at first well peopled, with many settlements, large and small. Then, as the days increased, the road ran through stretches where not a grass blade grew, places accursed, quite empty save for flitting figures afar off, assuredly bent on no good. The armed men of the train scarce let their bows from their hands. Yet even at the very worst, civilization did not quite forsake them. It went with them as God went with them, though with some dreadful gaps where it seemed there was no more trust save in God alone. Most of the time, however, it was visible in the shape of protected desert springs, signposts, spy towers, and rest places set up and kept in repair by the spirit of commerce up to their goal. That is to say, to the region where the priceless land of Egypt had already pushed its guards and wards a good piece into the wilderness. After that came the actual border and the definite place of entry. The walls of the fortress fell. They reached it in 17 days, or perhaps a few more. Anyhow, they considered it to be 17, and would have scorned to reckon it up. Certainly it was something resembling 17. Maybe less, maybe more. It might easily have been a bit more, at least if one counted in the days at Beersheba, for the summer sun still had power, and for the sake of sparing the father, they only got forward morning and evening. Yes, it was fully 17 days since they had left Mamre and set out. In other words, given themselves over for some time to a life of wandering and tenting. And now the days in their hours had brought them to Thel, the fortress, through which their way led to Joseph's kingdom. Lest anyone be concerned about the difficulties of our travelers at the forbidding border stronghold, let him be reassured. For good heavens, they had passes, papers, and official escort. Certainly no people of the wretched lands, knocking at the gates of Egypt, had ever traveled so accompanied. For them, there were no gates, no walls, no gratings. The outworks and towers of Thel were thin air. There was nothing but smiling politeness in lieu of the usual control. Pharaoh's officers had their orders, of course, touching these travelers, orders to which they bowed. The children of Israel were invited into the land by no less a person than Menphe's Lord of Bread, the shadow dispenser of the king, Jepnutif Onech, Pharaoh's universal friend, invited to pasture and settle. Difficulties? Trouble? The very litter in which they carried their old chieftain within the walls spoke for itself and its occupant. For it bore the uraeus. It came from Pharaoh's storehouses. And he who sat in it, the gentle, solemn, tired old man, they were bearing him to the nearby rendezvous with his son, a pretty highly placed personage who could put in corpse color anyone who even asked these children of Israel any questions, however politely. It is impossible to picture the officer's bearing as more flattering and obsequious than it was. The bronze grating swung open. The Jacob people passed through rows of upstretched hands across the drawbridge, with luggage and trotting flocks, into a swampy, marshy pastureland with scattered clumps of trees, dams, ditches, and hamlets. This was Pharaoh's land. This was Goshen, also called Kosen, Kesem, Goshen, and Goshen. Thus varied were the pronunciations of the little people working on a strip of land beside the towing path, bordered by ditches and reeds. The travelers' route led them along this path, and they inquired of the cultivators whether they were on the right road. If they went on westwards for one short day's travel, they were told, they would reach the Per Bastet arm of the Nile and the city of that name, the abode of the she-cat. But nearer still lay the substantial little city of Pak Kos, market and county seat, which probably gave its name to the district. For looking abroad over the land with its meadows and marshes, its mirror-like ponds, its islets of shrubbery and soggy flatlands, they saw the pylon of Pak Kos's temple against the morning sky. It was early when Israel entered into Egypt, having camped before the fort the night before, and they went on for a couple of hours towards the monument on the horizon. Then they halted, and Jacob's litter was let down from the asses' backs, for somewhere near the market of Pa-Kos, not far from here, was the place Joseph had appointed for the meeting, whither he had said he would come to greet his family. There is no doubt that this was a definite arrangement. The story says, "He sent Judah on before him to Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen." But it would be a mistake to conclude that Judah went on to the house of the swaddled one, and only thereupon did Joseph make ready his escort and set out to meet his father at Goshen. No, the exalted one was already close at hand, and had been for a couple of days. Judah was merely sent out into the neighborhood to seek him and take him to their father. "Here will Israel wait on his lordship and son," said Jacob. "Put me down. And thou, Jehudah, my son, take 3 servants and ride hence and find me out thy brother, Rachel's firstborn, and tell him where we are." And Judah obeyed. Certainly he was not long gone, only an hour or so, and came back after he had found Joseph. That he did not come with Joseph is clear from the question which Jacob, as we shall hear, asked as Joseph approached. It was a charming spot where Jacob waited. 3 palm trees, growing, it seemed, from 1 root, shaded his seat. And coolness came from a little pool with tall papyrus and blue and rose-colored lotus blossoms. There he sat, surrounded by his sons, the 10, who were 11 as soon as Judah got back. In front of Jacob lay the open meadow and pasture land, with birds flying across and across. His old eyes could look far out to where the 12th should appear. Now he saw Judah posting up with his 3 servants. They nodded and motioned behind them across the land without saying a word. So he looked where they pointed. And out there, afar off, something was stirring. There was a glittering and a flashing, a shimmer of color. It rolled on swiftly and turned into chariots with prancing steeds and shining harness, gay with feathers. Runners were in front and rear and at the sides. They all fixed their eyes on the foremost car, above which were poles with fans. On it came. It grew to full size, and they could see distinct figures in it. Jacob gazed too, his old hands shading his eyes. Now he said to one of his sons who stood beside him, "Judah." "Here I am, father," he answered. "Who is the fairly thick-set man?" asked Jacob. "Arrayed in all the splendor of this world, just getting down from his car, and the gilded basket of his car, and his neck ornament is like the rainbow, and his garment altogether like the brightness of heaven?" "That is your son Joseph, father," replied Judah. "If it is indeed he," said Jacob, "then I will get up and go to meet him." And although Benjamin and the others at first tried to prevent him, he rose from the litter with their help in labored stateliness, limping from the hip more than ever, for he purposely exaggerated his lameness. Alone, he went up to the other, who hastened his steps to shorten the distance between them. The man's smiling lips shaped the word, "Father," and he held his arms open before him. But Jacob had his own stretched out like a blind man groping. His hands moved as though beckoning, yet partly too as though to protect himself. For as they came close, he did not allow Joseph to fall on his neck and hide his face on his shoulder, as his son would have done. Instead, he peered and searched with his tired old eyes, his head laid back and sideways, peered long and urgently into the Egyptian's face with love and sorrow painted on his own, and did not recognize his son. But it came to pass that Joseph's eyes slowly filled with tears under Jacob's gaze. Their blackness swam in moisture. They overflowed. And lo, they were Rachel's eyes, Rachel's dewy cheeks, where Jacob in life's dreamy long ago had kissed away the tears. Now he knew his son. He let his head fall on the stranger's shoulder, and wept bitter tears. They stood there alone, for the brothers kept back, and so did Joseph's train, his marshal, his écuyer, his runners and fan-bearers, and likewise all the curious from the nearby little city held aloof. "Father, do you forgive me?" asked the son, and in that question he begged forgiveness for much, for playing fast and loose, and for deceit, for childish arrogance and incorrigible naughtiness, for self-esteem and blind conceit, for 100 follies for which he had atoned with the silence of the dead, living behind the back of the old man who suffered with him. "Father, can you forgive me?" Jacob straightened himself and stood erect, his self-control restored. "God has forgiven us," he answered. "You see he has, for he has given you back to me, and Israel can die happy since you have come back."
"And you to me," Joseph said. "Little father, may I call you that again?"
"If it is agreeable to you, my son," answered Jacob with formality, and old and dignified as he was, he bowed a little before the young man. "I should prefer to have you call me just Father, that the heart may compose itself in seriousness and not jest." Joseph understood perfectly. "I hear and obey," said he, and bowed in his turn. "But no more nonsense about dying," he added gaily. "Live, Father. We shall live together, the penance being performed and the long lack made good." "It was bitterly long," the old man nodded, "for his anger is mighty, and his wrath the wrath of a great and mighty God. He is so great and mighty that he can have no other kind of anger, no lesser kind, and he punishes us weaklings that our cries pour out like water."
"It would be understandable," said Joseph conversably, "if he could not in his greatness quite measure, and could not, he who has not his like, quite put himself in the place of the likes of us. It may be he has a somewhat heavy hand, so that the weight of it is almost crushing, even though he does not mean it so, and would only prick us and stroke us."
Jacob could not forbear to smile. "I see," he rejoined, "my son still has his old delightful keenness of perception in God matters, even of stranger gods. What it has pleased you to say may have some truth in it. Even Abraham in his time often reproached him for his intemperance, and I know I myself once spoke to him in the same sense. Gently, gently, Lord, not so hasty. But he is as he is, and cannot make himself more moderate for the sake of our weak hearts."
"A friendly restraining hand," Joseph responded, "as of one whom he loves, can do no harm. But now we will praise his mercy and his forgiving spirit, even though it has taken him such a long time. For his greatness is like only to his wisdom. I mean the fullness of his thought and the rich meaning of his acts. Always there is added manifold action to his decrees. That is the admirable thing. When he punishes, he indeed means punishment. And this serious purpose is both for his own sake and as means to the furtherance of great events. You, my father, and me, he had seized upon roughly and torn us apart, so that I died to you. He meant it, and he did it so. But at the same time, he meant to bring me hither before you, in order to save you, that I should provide for your needs, yours and the brother's, and your whole house, in the famine, which he designed in manifold meaning, and which in its turn was a means to much. But above all, that we should come together again. All that is highly admirable in all its interweavings. We blow hot or cold, but his passion is providence, and his anger far-seeing goodness. Has your son come somewhere near to fit expression about God the Father?"
"Somewhere near," Jacob confirmed him. "He is the God of life,
and life, of course, one only gets somewhere near. This to praise and excuse you, but you need no praise of mine, for you are praised of kings. May your life, which you have led in the place whither you were snatched, be not all too much in need of excuse. He said this while his mistrustful gaze traveled down the figure of the Egyptian Joseph, from the striped green and yellow headdress, the gleaming ornaments, the costly fashionable costume, the rich jeweled tools in his girdle and his hand, on down to the gold buckles of his sandal shoes. "Child," he said earnestly, "have you kept your purity among a people whose lust is like the lust of the ass and the stallion?" "Oh, dear little father, father," answered Joseph in some embarrassment, "why does my dear lord trouble so? Let be. The children of Egypt are as other children, not essentially better or worse. Believe me, only Sodom in its time was especially distinguished in evil. Since it was swallowed up in fire and brimstone, things are pretty much the same everywhere in this respect. In other words, they are so-so. You yourself once warned God and said to him, 'Not so hasty.' So it will not be a sin if now I, your child, warn you and would like in my love to advise you that since you are here, do not let the people of this country see what you think of them. Do not sit in judgment on their behavior in the light of your own spirit. Rather, forget not that we are strangers and gerim here, and Pharaoh has made me great among these children. Therefore, take a position among them according to God's will." "I know, my son, I know," answered Jacob, and again he made a little bow. "Do not doubt of my respect for the world. You say you have sons?" he added. "Yes, indeed, father, from my maiden, the daughter of the sun, a very aristocratic woman. Their names..."
"Maiden, daughter of the sun, that does not put me off. I have grandchildren from Shechem, and grandchildren from Moab, and have grandchildren from Midian. Why not grandchildren from a daughter of On? After all, it is myself from whom they descend." "What are the boys called?"
"Manasseh, father, and Ephraim."
"Ephraim and Manasseh. Good, my son, my lamb. It is very good that you have sons, two of them, and have given them such names. I will see them. As soon as possible, you will bring them before me, if you will."
"At your command, father," said Joseph.
"And do you know, dear child," Jacob went on softly and wet-eyed, "why it is so good and so fitting before the Lord